United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All evidence before this court draw near and shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Peach. To my left is Judge Ringberg. We're here today in the matter of consolidated cases, Ward against Wilkie, docket number 16-2157, and Neal against Wilkie, docket number 17-1204. To consider whether the board erred in providing instructions to the VA examiners in both cases that aggravation required a permanent worsening of a putative secondary condition. And the second issue is whether the court has authority to certify a class of veterans who are or will be subject to the Secretary's application of a permanent worsening standard for deciding whether a service-connected disability has aggravated a secondary disability. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Your Honor, for Appellants Neal Ward in the proposed class, I'm Casey Connolly. I'm a law student with the Veterans Legal Clinic of the Legal Services Center of Harvard Law School. With me today at counsel's table is Laurel Fresquez, also a law student at the Veterans Legal Clinic. She will be presenting rebuttal. And with us today as well are Elizabeth Gwynn of the Veterans Legal Clinic and Zachary Stolz of Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick.
Familiar faces. Welcome. Thank you. Counsel for the Secretary.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Lavinia Durr, and with me as co-counsel is Ronan Morris and Deputy Chief Counsel James Cowan.
Great. Welcome. A few familiar faces as well. Are the parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Counsel.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. We are covering two issues. We have decided to entertain the merits discussion first and the class action second in that order. It is likely that you will have more questions from the bench than our time will permit, at least the 30 minutes. But as I often do, as I see it necessary to extend time, we will do so. In order to get our questions answered. Okay, so we will start with each party having 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, we'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Counsel for the appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. At the roots, these cases are enforcement cases. To that end, and to Chief Judge Davis's point, we'd first like to address the merits and then turn to class certification as the appropriate remedy.
Ms. Connolly, let me ask you a question. Isn't this case informed or at least or possibly controlled by Allen?
Yes, Your Honor. Allen is indeed controlling for this case. As we noted in our briefing, Allen, which was decided in 1995, noted that any increase in severity could be service-connected for claims under 3310. And the Secretary, in codifying 3310B in 1997, recognized the court's decision in Allen there. And so in 1995, we already have an answer from this court on the legal question today. And that is actually part of the reason why we believe this case is uniquely suited to class certification as a remedy. We already have a legal question answered for us, and the Secretary's inconsistent application of the unlawful permanent worsening standard in both Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward's cases, as well as with regard to the proposed class members, is, as the Federal Circuit noted in Monk, is ripe for class certification in order for this court to enforce the correct legal standard. The plain language of 3310B merely states that any increase in severity shall be service-connected. And indeed, as you've noted, Chief Judge Davis, Alan V. Brown supports that reading. And indeed, it's quite surprising that in the M21 manual, the Secretary then cites to Alan V. Brown as support for the permanent worsening standard, when in fact, nowhere in that opinion and nowhere in the Federal Register codifying the court's opinion in Allen is there a mention of permanent worsening. And in fact, it's only until this court...
It's not in the regulations either, is it?
It is not in the regulation, Your Honor.
Well, isn't that the whole point? To have a regulation that's inconsistent with the way in which the Secretary implements his own regulation.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's what you want
rectified. Yes, the Secretary is inconsistently applying a higher standard than is required both under the court's ruling in Allen v. Brown and as codified by the Secretary himself at 3310B. And as the Federal Circuit noted in Monk, in cases where there is a systemic error that is reaching veterans' claims at all levels of the system, class certification is a good tool for this court to correct that error and ensure that like veterans, such as Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward in the proposed class, are treated alike. And furthermore, in other instances where this exact legal question, that is whether the permanent worsening standard is unlawful, the Secretary has mooted out those claims and joined motions for remand. For example, in Cook v. McDonald and Brian v. Shulkin, both of which were slated for a precedential panel review before this court, the Secretary in both of those cases mooted out and sent the question back to the board on the permanent worsening question.
Yeah, tried to pick them off so that they wouldn't be confronted with a class certification.
Precisely, Your Honor. And as the Federal Circuit noted in Monk, in instances where the Secretary has tried to frustrate the court's ability to judicially review legal questions, such as the permanent worsening question, class certification is not only appropriate, but it's a necessary tool for this court to take back its jurisdiction and to enforce the proper legal standard as applied to veterans' 3310B claims.
Why wouldn't a panel decision considered precedential be sufficient? Why do you need class certification in order to accomplish what you want to on behalf of the individual veterans and the world at large?
There's a few reasons, Your Honor. First, we already have a precedential opinion. We have Allen, and that has already proven to not be enough in this case to ensure that the Secretary is applying the correct legal standard to veterans through 3310B claims. And second, the class certification is the only way to protect the interests of the absent class members here. At least since 2011, when the manual was revised to include the permanent worsening standard, possibly thousands of veterans have had their claims adjudicated under this wrong legal standard. And as your colleague Judge Bartley noted in her single judge decision in Mickelson v. Shulkin, it's impossible to know in some cases whether veterans were prejudiced with the application of this unlawful standard because the wrong legal question is being asked of the examiners and of the RO adjudicators who are in fact bound by the manual. And so that's why we need class certification in this case, to correct, as the Federal Circuit noted in Monk, to correct a systemic error that infiltrates the system from the from the RO and the CNP exam level all the way up to the BVA. And now today the question is before this court.
And I assume that as part of the class action proceeding, similar to that which takes place in Article III courts, broad notice would be required by the court and constant supervision of the maintenance of the class action by the court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that would avoid the situation we found ourselves in Staub. Familiar with that case?
Only a little bit, Your Honor. But
this court decided in a precedential opinion that actions of the... in fact, there are two members of this panel who were on that panel. That the secretary was acting in violation of a statute and took over 2 years to pay the veteran while the secretary went about other activities. So wouldn't that be another reason to compel immediate action through the means of class certification?
Certainly, Your Honor. As you pointed out, a precedential opinion would merely be a declaration of law, whereas a certification of the class and using that as an enforcement mechanism to ensure that the secretary is, in fact, complying with this court's ruling under the All Writs Act would be a more efficient and a more effective enforcement mechanism.
Well, what about this? What if we said, all right, we're not going to certify the class for whatever reasons, but here we're issuing a panel decision and we're ordering the secretary to publish the determination of the panel, and if there are more than one opinion, all the opinions, in va.gov or some other website or some other means of communication with virtually every veteran who is signed up or signed with the secretary. Wouldn't that accomplish it?
Your Honor, while notice...
No, it won't.
While notice would certainly be a good thing, no, we don't believe that what you're suggesting would accomplish what class certification could accomplish.
What's the difference?
Well, a precedential opinion, for example, wouldn't give an enforceable judgment to the proposed class members who have already had their claims adjudicated under the improper legal standard and have had their claims prejudiced because of that improper legal standard. Whereas with the class certification, that could require the secretary to go back and take a second look at all of those claims that had been adjudicated under the improper
standard.
You
want us to apply this retroactively?
Only to claims that are still live, Your Honor. We would not be asking this court or the secretary to go back and look at claims that are not within a live appeal period, with the exception of the date of the filing of our motion for class certification, which is November 30th, 2017. As we noted in our motion, we understood that filing to have automatically told the appeal deadline for proposed class members moving forward. So anyone as of November, who is live as of November 30th, 2017, we believe would be covered retroactively.
I suppose I ought to know this. What took so long? November 2017?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that our fault that it's taken this long?
I am not sure about the reasons for the delay.
That's pretty astounding. But
well,
there it is.
So anyway,
you want us to go back to November 2017?
Yes,
and
all claims that were live as of that date.
Right.
We understood to still be alive today, regardless of whether they might have died otherwise because of the expiration of the appeal
period.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Connolly, following up on Judge Greenberg's questioning, if we rule on the merits, could we simultaneously also make a certification decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we ruled on the certification decision, could we also then rule on the merits?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that both decisions could be ruled on simultaneously. In fact, we believe that the two issues are so intertwined.
But isn't there some notice requirements under the certification process that would almost require a different time frame?
We believe notice would come in the post-certification stage. So at this stage, we're merely asking the court to certify the proposed class. And then the steps we envision happening post-certification, we, for example, would look for the court to issue some kind of order for the parties, the secretary and the appellants, to confer in a Rule 33-like conference to discuss the next post-certification steps, which would include identification, how the secretary is going to go about identifying the potential class members, a timeline for re-adjudication, re-examination of those claims, a possible timeline for check-ins with the parties and the court, as well as how the secretary is going to provide notice to class members, and also confidentiality issues and going over how information is going to be shared between the parties. Okay. After that conference, we would then plan to come back to the court. If the parties agree on some points, we would ask the court to enter an enforceable order that would then put a burden on the secretary to comply with that order. And if the parties disputed anything, then the court, in a very familiar context, could make a ruling on a dispute between the parties.
So in other words, what you're asking for is something analogous, if not identical, to customary day-in and day-out activities of Article III courts in supervising class actions.
Exactly, Your Honor. Right. For all that, the class action context is new with this court. We believe that the underlying procedure that would follow certifying a class here would actually be familiar and manageable. And in fact, we believe it's necessary in this case. And so merely the fact that it's a new context for this court should not be a reason to potentially shy away from certifying a class where it's so necessary, especially given that this court has direct guidance from the Federal Circuit in Monk to certify a class where many of the factors that are present in this case today are present. The secretary in the past has been mooting out claims, frustrating this court's precedential review ability on the exact legal question that's here today. This is a way for the court to take back its jurisdiction. And we have a manageable and limited yet numerous class that the court can affect by certifying the class and ordering the secretary to go back and take a second look at those claims.
What about the people who are not a part of the class but have been impacted by an inappropriate or different standard applied by the secretary, the permanent worsening standard? What happens to those people? And they already have decisions with an inappropriate worsening standard.
Your Honor, to clarify, are you referring to people whose claims might be dead and then therefore wouldn't be included in the proposed class?
Who were decided before November 30th, 2017, right?
Your Honor, we're not sure if it would be possible under this court's jurisdiction to include those with dead claims under the class. Mm-hmm.
But in any event, it's not necessary for us to deal with that issue. Is that your argument?
It is not, given the proposed class we have.
Some of those people may come back separately, assert a different class, or ask for retroactive consideration of their determinations.
Certainly, those individuals could petition the court separately, and while it's unfortunate that our class isn't able to capture everyone who was harmed by the secretary's unlawful standard, the class certification procedure remains the best way to do the most good for the most veterans. And so simply because some veterans might be excluded from that class is not a reason to not certify. As we've shown in our briefing, the class is numerous, and many people have been affected by the application of this standard. And what's more, all of these veterans, by definition, have multiple disabilities. And many of them, such as Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward, have been caught in the system for years waiting for their claims to be adjudicated. And so it's only fair, and in fact it's necessary, to certify the class in this case.
Let me ask you to step back for a moment from the class certification issue to Regulation 3.310. Do you have a copy of that in front of you?
I have 3310B in front of me, Your Honor.
Right. If you could look at paragraph B, the sentence beginning with however.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't have that. Okay. Would you like me to read it out loud, Your Honor?
Please.
However, VA will not concede that a non-service-connected disease or injury was aggravated by a service-connected disease or injury unless the baseline level of severity of the non-service-connected disease or injury is established by medical evidence created before the onset of aggravation or by the earliest medical evidence created at any time between the onset of aggravation and the receipt of medical evidence establishing the current level of severity of the non-service-connected disease or injury.
What kind, how would one go about providing that evidence?
Well, Your Honor, certainly the way to go about providing that evidence would not be any different from the way that medical evidence is provided in all other VA adjudication procedures. The Secretary maintained in his briefing that the permanent worsening standard is the way that the Secretary tries to measure the degree of aggravation above the baseline injury. But in fact, permanent is not necessary in order to do that. The Secretary, in many other contexts, is able and does compensate for non-permanent disabilities. Under regulations 4.1 and 4.40, the Secretary compensates for non-permanent disabilities. The Secretary is able to do staged ratings to improvise and make do when veterans' disabilities change. And under rulings like McLean and Saunders, the Secretary has recognized that subjective, non-measurable disabilities such as pain can in fact be compensated.
So who has the burden here in providing this kind of baseline assessment and evidence? Is this burden on the appellant or is it on the Secretary or where should it be?
I believe the duty is on the VA to assist the veteran in developing the claim, Your Honor. And so to the extent that, for example, as in Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward's cases, when the BVA remanded those claims on the aggravation questions and instructed the VA examiners to use the permanent worsening standard, the VA failed its duty to assist by instructing VA examiners to use the wrong legal standard to assess the veterans' claims. And the veterans were denied on those bases, and thus they were prejudiced by the Secretary's actions and application of the unlawful permanent worsening standard.
But if the baseline is for a non-service-connected condition, how would the VA carry that burden of proof if it's for non-service-connected?
The burden is on the veteran to establish evidence of the aggravation, but there is also a burden on the VA to assist the veteran in developing that claim. And indeed, permanent is not required in order for a veteran, either on the VA side, to assess the claim or for the veteran to prove aggravation. The application of the permanent worsening standard, where it's not actually required, would be akin to asking a criminal defendant to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt where only a preponderance standard was required. It's simply higher, and the plain language of the regulation makes that clear. 3310B states that any increase in severity will be service-connected. It says nothing about permanent, and permanent means forever. And therefore, the Secretary's unlawful application of the permanent worsening standard here is prejudicial not only to Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward, but to all of the class members. And that's why we're here, to ask the court to certify the class and correct the legal error.
But you mentioned that any worsening of the condition will be compensated. But is there some further analysis that would take place? You read the sentence about the basic baseline and the increase. So there's some sort of an analysis that needs to take place based on, I guess, the evidence, any evidence. So the outcome of the analysis might not end up in compensation.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I answer the question?
You may. You just had the additional time added.
Thank you. I'm sorry, could you repeat just the end of the question? It's fine, Your Honor.
You mentioned that any evidence would result in compensation, but the sentence that you read dealt with some sort of a formula or an analysis that would have to take place. And maybe that analysis will not result in compensation.
Certainly, Your Honor. We, in fact, do not believe that every re-adjudication of the claims of the potential class members would or should end up in a result of compensation. What we're asking is for the Secretary to go back and take a second look at each of those claims and see, in each case, whether the veteran was or could have been prejudiced by the application of the standard.
Going back into the class action thing.
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that the merits questions and the class certification are very intertwined.
And you would prefer a class action over a precedential opinion that would take care of both Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward in the relative near future? Or do you want to hold their cases hostage to a class action procedure that you sort of outlined earlier?
Your Honor, I'm not sure where the hostage-taking would take place.
Well, if we issued a presidential opinion, it would take care of Mr. Ward and Mr. Neal, whatever the opinion says. Let's assume it's favorable. And so then they would end up getting their opinion, but are you saying we would go ahead and give them their relief and then go ahead and still kind of work this class action aspect?
Well, yes, presumably, Your Honor, even if the court were to make a favorable ruling on the merits for Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward, their claims would then have to be remanded back to the board and possibly back all the way down to the C&P examiners to do another exam with the correct standard this time. And so I don't believe that the imposition of a class certification procedure would impose any more significant delay in Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward's cases than is already inherent in the VA system.
But then the presidential decision would be the standard for VA to apply across the board then for cases that it would apply to.
That is true, Your Honor. But without the class action, the court doesn't have an enforcement mechanism to make sure that the secretary is actually applying the correct legal standard. In addition, the presidential opinion wouldn't be able to order the secretary to change the M21, which is binding on the RO level and informs the decision making by the BVA as well.
Now let me ask one more question, if I might. Where do you think this standard of aggravation about a permanent worsening, that's the same? Where do you think VA came up with that, or why do you think they came up with it?
Well, Your Honor, this court's ruling in Donilon v. Shinseki in 2010 clarified that claims under 38 U.S.C. 1153, sorry, that is cited in the Secretary's Neal brief, I believe. And the court in that case stated that permanent worsening is the correct standard for 1153 claims. And following that ruling in 2011, the VA then revised the M21 manual to reflect that permanent worsening language. But then the VA cited to Allen v. Brown immediately following the permanent worsening language in the manual as support for that proposition. But if you go back and look at the court's ruling in Allen v. Brown, at pin site 445 and again at 448, the court in Allen v. Brown specifically distinguished between aggravation claims under 3310, which falls under statute 38 U.S.C. 1110, and aggravation claims under 38 U.S.C. 1153. And so we believe that the current misinterpretation and misapplication of the permanent worsening standard in the 3310B context comes from the Secretary's conflation of the court's ruling in Donilon about 1153 claims with the court's ruling in Allen distinguishing between 1153 and 3310B. And so we are now looking for the court to certify the class in order to ensure that going forward and retroactively, where it's possible to re-adjudicate claims, ensure that the correct legal standard is applied to veterans who brought 3310B claims and were adjudicated under the unlawful permanent worsening standard.
Do you think Allen is still good law, considering Allen and Donlin were based on injuries occurring in service and aggravation occurring in service, and what we have here are situations that occur post-service?
Well, Your Honor, 3310B was, I see my time is about to expire again.
It's about to be increased.
Thank you, Your Honor. 3310B was promulgated by the Secretary in 1997 in direct response to Allen v. Brown. So 3310B is, in fact, a codification of this court's ruling in Allen. And so we don't believe that Allen is bad law now because that case was specifically about in-service aggravation. And furthermore, the court they're distinguished between claims under 3310 and more broadly 1110 were distinct from claims under 1153. And so there's no coherent policy reason for the Secretary to be applying permanent worsening for 3310B claims.
Holly, you mentioned the M21, and I noticed that the permanent worsening standard is in the M21 as well.
It is.
So, but you said the court couldn't order the Secretary to change the M21. Why not?
Well, merely issuing a precedential opinion, I believe, under the ruling of DAV, this court cannot, parties cannot directly challenge a specific portion of the M21. But we're not here today to do that. We're challenging the Secretary's application of the standard as evidenced in the M21.
Yeah, I understand, but if we were to issue a precedential opinion, it seems to me we would need to fix all aspects of it. And if the permanent standard permeates the M21, it seems to me a court order or opinion should also address that as well. I mean, that needs to be remedied, because if it's not, the regional offices will be following the M21, right?
Yes, certainly, Your Honor. And, in fact, that's why we're here, to ask for class certification on this question today. While a precedential opinion can do some work, it can't do all of the work. And if the court were to certify a class, then it would have an enforceable judgment. It could order the Secretary to go back and change the M21. And appellants serving as class counsel could then hold Secretary accountable and come back to this court with an enforceable judgment in hand to ensure that the Secretary is actually complying. And therefore, we could avoid some of the problems that you mentioned in STOP, for instance, Judge Greenberg. As the Federal Circuit has already told us in Monk, this is the best and most efficient way for the court to correct a systemic error and ensure that like veterans are treated alike. And when we have veterans such as Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward, as well as the proposed class members, whose claims have undoubtedly been prejudiced by the Secretary's unlawful application of a higher standard than is required by both this court's ruling and by the regulation, class certification is appropriate and necessary to correct the injustice, especially when we're dealing with a class of people who both Congress and the courts have singled out as a special class who is deserving of solicitude from the courts. And it's only fair to ask the Secretary to go back and take a second look at those claims through the class certification procedure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Sir, you may have 10 additional minutes if you need them.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
I'll start with the same question I asked Ms. Connolly. Doesn't Allen control this case?
Yes, Your Honor. We agree that Allen does control the case. In Allen, they did say that any increase in severity would be service-connected. However, within Allen, it also says that the aggravation of the veteran's non-service-connected condition that is proximately due to the aggravation of the service-connected condition shall only be compensated to the degree of disability over and above the degree of disability existing prior to the aggravation.
Right.
As noted earlier, there is a baseline that needs to be presented.
Well, before you get to the baseline, let's talk a little bit about the language in Allen.
And why.
The Secretary is using the permanent worsening standard in a different statutory section and regulate.
Well, both statutes are in Chapter 11 of within those statutes. The case basically evolved from, these cases have evolved 1110 and 1153 from the aggravation cases. And pre-service aggravation was used as a permanent worsening. When Allen was instituted, when Allen was decided, later on, we promulgated 3.310B that didn't include the permanent worsening, but did include the holding in Allen that there needs to be, it's the degree above the non-service-connected condition, which is service-connected. So the VA had used similar terms with permanent worsening. So worsening, there is in Allen, the worsening of a condition in order to present service connection. It's actually the degree of disability.
unlike other...
So do you concede that the standard applied by the board in these two cases was incorrect?
No, Your Honor. We agree with the permanent worsening. The permanent, the worsening part is a degree of disability. The worsening is a degree of disability above what the non-service connected condition, the aggravation. Right. The permanent part deals with how we're interpreting it is some kind of measurability, that it can't be temporary or fleeting, as noted in the other aggravation cases under Hunt. It has to be something that's measurable. So if you have a non-service connected condition, there has to be the baseline, and anything above that, it has to be a measurable degree of disability above the what the non-service connected condition is, above the natural progress. Under 3.310B, it does state that it should be above what the natural progress of the condition. So there is.
Is that because you're looking at determining what the impairment of earning capacity is, which is what Alan set forth?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it's, so that permanent
worsening.
Is a result to, you could determine the impairment.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Which would be permanent.
Yes, unlike other service connection cases where you're given a condition, a current condition, in this case, it's a degree of disability above the non-service connected condition that is actually service connected. If you can show that you have a degree of service connection above the non-service connected condition that was worsened beyond the natural progress, again, 3.310B acknowledges that most conditions would potentially worsen over time.
But why would you ask the medical examiner to say permanent disability? Wouldn't that be something the rating officer would look into based on that medical based on the medical evidence submitted?
So Your Honor, it was in this case. It was aggravation was defined in both requests to the both medical examiners.
But I believe in parentheses it said permanent worsening.
Yes, Your Honor. It was noted as permanent worsening, and those instructions were given to both VA medical examiners. Then both VA medical examiners discussed that there was no aggravation at all of the condition, so no baseline was given. It is the job of the rating specialist as well as or the board to determine the degree of disability, the degree of impairment, if there is any, to interpret basically what the medical evidence says in this case.
If I may, am I reading this correctly? At least a portion of the regulation 3.310B says, I'm quoting now, any increase in severity of a non-service connected disease or injury that is proximately due to or the result of a service connected disease or injury and not due to the natural progress of the non-service connected disease will be service connected. I think that's as of 2007, the addition of the regulation. That's the regulation. Isn't that entirely consistent with the holding of this court, which said when aggravation of a veteran's non-service connected condition is proximately due to or the result of a service-connected condition, such veteran shall be compensated for the degree of disability, but only that degree over and above the degree of disability existing prior to aggravation. That's Allen. Aren't those two consistent?
Yes,
therefore, my question is, where does the word permanent, the concept of permanently worsened come in?
We agree, Your Honor, that the term permanent is not in the regulation or the statute.
But you're applying that standard. You're telling your people out in the field to apply a permanently worsened standard when neither your regulation nor the decision of this court in 1995 require that.
Again, Your Honor, within the regulation, it does state, again, after, as Judge Davis pointed out, that the VA will not concede to a non-service-connected disease or injury was aggravated by service-connected disease unless the baseline level of severity of the non-service-connected disease or injury is established.
So our
what's that got to do with permanently worsened?
Our position is, Your Honor, that permanently worsened just means a measurable amount of worsening of the condition.
Who measures it?
The veteran has the burden of establishing service connection. However, through VA assistance, the VA is responsible to give, if medical evidence is required, to give a medical examination in these types of cases.
Well, where's the standard for permanently worsened, even assuming that was a correct application? How do your people in the field know from your M21 how to determine permanently worsened versus any increase, which is what the regulation says?
Again, Your Honor, it says any increase. However, it is within the same regulation. It does say that there needs to be a baseline. Anything above that would be considered the service-connected condition. And if you read the regulation as well, Your Honor, it says any increase in severity in the first part. However, in the end of the regulation, it does say that any increase in severity due to the natural progress of the disease from the current level, that won't be service-connected. So if you use any so generally, the regulation doesn't make sense. If you use any in terms of any increase that is above the degree of disability that is aggravated by the service-connected condition, then that is what is service-connected. It's not just any increase. It has to be a baseline. It has to be measurable. It has to be above what that baseline is, what was aggravated.
Mr., I got that. Let me ask you this. Can there be something that's less than a permanent worsening that could be measurable and contribute to establishing a baseline?
Your Honor, we agree that once it's measurable, then that then can be service-connected. So stage ratings can apply in these types of cases. So if it resolves itself within, you know, it's measurable for a certain period of time, the baseline is going to be the symptoms of the non-service-connected condition.
Yeah, I understand.
Afterwards, if there are symptoms worsened, basically, after that, and an examiner can say how it worsened. Right. After that, if it resolves itself, then stage ratings can be given for that part that was aggravated for the time period that was aggravated.
But there could be something that's less than permanent worsening that would help to establish a baseline as well.
Yes, Your Honor. Again, we are interpreting permanent in terms of being measurable, just something that's not temporary or fleeting. How these line of cases came from the 1153 aggravation cases.
Right.
So VA had used that standard of permanent worsening. This wasn't put in a vacuum. These cases were decided before, and as it progressed, that term was used, even though it wasn't in the statute or the regulation.
Do you expect the examiner to use the term permanently aggravated, permanently worsening? Is that the expectation?
No, Your Honor. The expectation is to be able to provide a baseline, whether or not they can provide a baseline of the non-service-connected condition. As you said, appellant has to present evidence of the non-service-connected condition. VA does not keep records of, conditions when we have that isn't service-connected. And then, in this case, neither the examiners stated that it was a part that the appellant did, that either appellant didn't show showed permanent worsening. They just said it didn't aggravate the condition. That the condition wasn't aggravated.
What if they had said it was aggravated?
If it was aggravated, Your Honor, we would need to talk about a baseline, like I said, of the non-service-connected condition.
So any aggravation would work then?
No, Your Honor, it has to be aggravated with the 3.310B. Although it says any increase in the first sentence, it does talk about it has to be the baseline of the non-service-connected condition and the degree of disability above due to the aggravation and not due to natural progression of the disease.
In your M21, and I know it's your guidance to the field,
yes.
There was an extract that was accompanied by one of the briefs. I believe it was the appellant's brief. It was M21, Part 3, Subpart IV, small IV, Chapter 6, Section B, and it talked about service-connected conditions, and it has to be permanently worsened. Okay. But then I go to another section of your manual dealing with determining to which extent a non-service-connected disability was aggravated by a service-connected disability, and it just says aggravation is established by any increase in severity. So, and that was, instituted later. But why is there such an inconsistency?
Again, Your Honor, we have been using the permanent worsening standard, but applying it in terms of something that is measurable. Just, it has to be something, cannot be temporary fleeting, the same as the line of cases in the 1153 aggravation cases.
But you could have still measurable without that word permanent.
Again, Your Honor, that's how we've been interpreting it, in terms of in these cases where it's a service-connected condition aggravating a non-service-connected condition, it has to be some kind of measurable activity above the baseline. Whether or not, like I said, VA had been using permanent because it had followed the line of cases, the court's line of cases under 1153, and the use of aggravation. That's how this evolved. So,
you're blaming us?
No, Your Honor.
Seriously, where's the permanent worsening? Where's the determination? Maybe they didn't use the word aggravation or any because they thought they were applying a permanent worsening standard from your manual as opposed to the regulation. Who supervises these people?
Who
make the determinations in Ward and Neal? Where was the determination that there was no permanent worsening? How was it made? How were Ward and Neal determined no permanent worsening? We're applying the M21. Headquarters sends us this book, the intention of which I presume, if you're acting in good faith, is to try to get predictability and some sort of standard practice across the VA and how it analyzes veterans' conditions. Is that right?
Yes.
That's the point of your manual.
The manual, yes, Your Honor.
So, what is the determination here in Ward and Neal and any of the other thousands of cases?
Again, Your Honor.
A permanent worsening. I don't see it. What happened?
Again, Your Honor, it was in the instructions in terms of given by the board to these VA medical examiners. How we have treated it is just something in terms of something that's measurable. The regulation says that. Again, it doesn't even need to be permanently in terms of long-lasting. It just has to be something measurable because you cannot service connect something, any condition.
So why wouldn't the instruction be something measurable instead of permanently worsening?
Your Honor.
But let me ask another question because this gets to part of this as well, Mr. In the regulation section 3.310B, and I'm thinking about this from a practical standpoint, because the regulation calls for establishing a baseline, that's what you've been talking about.
Yes, Your Honor.
Something measurable, right? I won't use the word permanently worsening. I'll say something measurable. A baseline. And there's different ways of measuring that baseline. But it also requires that the baseline level of severity of the non-service-connected disease or injury has to be established by medical evidence before the onset of aggravation. How does one do that?
Well, again, Your Honor, if their claim either reasonably raised either of this type of issue, that service-connected condition, aggravated non-service-connected condition.
Which would be a secondary.
Exactly. Condition. If
which is post-service. Now,
yes.
Right?
The veteran can present evidence of the non-service-connected condition the rating specialist or the board can decide whether or not it can be decided at that point. If medical evidence is necessary, like in this case, in both Mr. Ward and Mr. Neal's case, the board will get an opinion, medical opinion, to see whether or not it was aggravated, the non-service-connected condition was aggravated by the service-connected condition.
Right.
So there is VA assistance if they meet the McClendon standards.
But that opinion has to basically be offer some kind of a diagnosis before the onset of the aggravation. So there has to be a baseline of, let's just say, normalcy initially.
A baseline of the condition.
Or whatever the condition is. First, before the onset of aggravation.
Yes, the appellant can present private medical evidence, lay evidence of his condition, and then the physician can make a medical opinion as to the and not only the baseline, Your Honor, whether or not what was due to the natural progress of the disease. Again, in the same 3.310B, it speaks about the natural progress of the disease because, I guess, inherently the condition will worsen. So it has to be what's beyond the natural progression, what is aggravated by the service-connected condition. To my co-counsel,
Ronan Moore. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms.
Morris?
Thank you, Your Honors. And, may it please the Court. Your Honors, with respect to the motion for class certification, not only should the Court deny that motion, but this case raises some serious questions and concerns regarding the use of class actions in this type of setting. Starting with the most basic of all questions, which is, does a class action actually serve the best interests of Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward and the proposed class, and is there any actual benefit gained by using the class action mechanism over the issuance of a precedential decision? And I submit to you, Your Honors, that the answer to both questions is no, and that, in fact, using a class action is may even be counterproductive and even undermine the interests of Mr. Neal, Mr. Ward, and
well,
the
well, they're here
class.
Arguing for it.
That's correct.
Well, you're not substituting your judgment for that of their counsel. They're here arguing for class action. Why don't you leave it up to them whether the best interests of their clients is served by asking for a class to be certified? What business is it of the Secretary?
2 points, Your Honor. One, they're intending to incorporate all veterans, and the Secretary does have an interest in the protection of all veterans generally. Their proposed class includes veterans who are not yet up here on appeal, who are not going to be a part of the action that they're attempting to initiate. So I do believe that the Secretary has a vested interest. But if I can explain my statement, Your Honor, I'd like to start by focusing on the actual requested relief. The appellants seek to certify a class under Rule 23b-2, which is an action or refusal to act, which results in an injunctive relief or a declaratory relief. That is precisely what the appellant is asking for, is a declaratory relief, which is odd that the appellant has stated that a precedential decision merely provides declaratory relief. That is what the appellant wants, a declaration as to the status of the law. A declaratory relief does not in and of itself compel any action, meaning that there is nothing further that comes with that. So under B2, that is the end of the story. There is no additional relief. But what the appellant really wants is something else. In this case, a vacature and remand. But there are problems with that. One, the appellant doesn't ask for that in the appellant's motion for class certification. The appellant doesn't ask for that for a very clear reason, because it's not permitted, because a remand clearly cannot be universally applied to the entire proposed class of veterans, because most, if not the overwhelming majority of them, don't even have final board decisions. So what's the court to do in that instance? Nothing. Declaratory relief puts the appellants in no better position than, even if they succeed on the merits of their arguments, it puts them in no better position than they are right now. They have a final board decision that has denied them benefits. So again, the appellants need something more. That something more can easily be provided by a presidential decision. That something more can even be provided by a single judge memorandum decision. It cannot be provided by relief under Section B2, which the Supreme Court in the Walmart case made clear. A B2 class action doesn't provide for individualized relief. So
Mr. Morris,
yes.
A precedential decision from this court will resolve fairly quickly Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward's issue. But what does the Secretary do with the other, if I remember the briefing, 700-plus cases where the incorrect standard may have been applied?
I will start by saying, Your Honor, we still maintain the position that we took in Ward and I believe Monk, meaning that the court doesn't actually, we don't believe that the court has subject matter jurisdiction over any claims which haven't resulted in a final board decision. But assuming, for the sake of argument, that entire class is up for grabs, what the Secretary does is no different than in every other case in which the court issues a precedential decision. The Secretary is bound by that, the regional office, the board is bound by that. Your Honor, appellate courts have functioned since their inception without the use of class actions themselves because of the force and effect of precedential decisions. They are binding, and here they are binding on the Secretary. Congress created a system, you know, the multi-layers of review, and so if a veteran had a claim adjudicated initially by the RO and the veteran's displeased, veteran appeals that, and perhaps it goes to a DRO or depending on where it is in the system, but at some point that would be corrected because the law would be properly applied. Again, this is assuming that the appellant succeeds in the merit, but I'll just run with that assumption here. So, Your Honor, again, granting the appellant's motion for class certification, again, puts them in no better position. And again, if the court were to somehow find the authority to tack on an additional order, which the Secretary's position is that it cannot under B2, it would still be faced with having to adjudicate every one of those claims themselves, you know, again, independently, to determine whether remand is appropriate, whether they're at a stage where remand might be warranted. It would also force the court to apply Congress's mandate of the rule of prejudicial error and determining that there's actually harm in all of those cases. So it saves no time to certify a class. In fact, it makes it more complicated because the members of the class then have to prove their membership in the class. The court has to review each claim independently anyway. And even if we were to narrow the class to those veterans with final board decisions, again, the court wouldn't be able to universally apply remand, not only because, again, it has to take account of the rule of prejudicial error, but also we don't know that a remand is even the best relief for veterans. It's possible that a reversal may be the best relief. And so for the appellants to suggest in any way that any particular uniform relief would be warranted for the entire class calls into question the requirements themselves of a class action, which is, are they actually in the best, you know, are their interests aligned with the rest of the class?
Would a precedential decision work to revise the M21 if the standard were?
It would become the governing law. If the court sides with the appellant in the merits of the argument, it would not be the first time that the court has issued a decision that is inconsistent with the M21. The M21 often reflects
We like to think the M21 might be inconsistent with the court's decision.
Correct. But the M21 often reflects the policies, they may contain expressions of the Secretary's policies or interpretations, so on and so forth. So in very many cases, and in fact in most cases, probably, where the court issues a decision interpreting a law, there may be it would supersede anything that would be inconsistent in the M21. So that grounds for fear, Your Honor, I don't believe is a valid ground. And I would note also, neither are the other other cautionary tales told by the appellant. First, I would like to note that the Secretary does not moot claims, direct appeals with JMRs. That is not a unilateral action by the Secretary. That is both parties coming together and determining it's the best interest of both of their clients. So if anyone is mooting it, it is certainly both parties. But it actually brings up, I think, a very significant and important point, which is that in those cases, the parties have agreed to the interests of their parties are being satisfied, meaning that if we were to certify classes in all of these types of cases where there's a question of interpretation, we'd be foregoing the ability of the parties to actually negotiate immediate relief, that ability to enter into a joint settlement, that ability to enter into a JMR. That is something that not only do we do at the behest of the court, it's in the court's rules that require the parties
to do that in a class action. Isn't that part of the negotiating process after
it would be near
class would be certified?
What I do not believe that that's necessarily authorized under a B2 motion, which is for injunctive type of relief. I mean, the Secretary wouldn't, it would make no sense for the Secretary to simply agree with the represented counsel as to here's the interpretation of a law, because that's actually the province of the court to determine the proper interpretation of the law and not a matter for the parties to compromise. But outside of that, it would be near impossible to look at every single case, determine on the merits of that whether there may be a harmful error, a harmless error, and to do this all at once and to work out individual individual JMRs. It may very well be there is a lot of strategic compromise that goes into JMRs, and it may be that we're not sure about this area of the law, but there's another issue that is probably an error. And again, all of this requires the explicit consent of the appellant, presumably in the interest of that client, and so depriving a client of the opportunity to have the Secretary offer a negotiated settlement or a negotiated, JMR seems, to be honest, counterproductive, and counterproductive to something that the court has been very concerned with, which is the party's ability to freely negotiate. And even in the class action context, settlements do have to be approved, typically by the court, and because you're dealing with large numbers of non-representative those who are being represented, even unaware of the case itself. So, Your Honor, I think that there are a lot of issues, and I think that the haste to use a class action, I think it can have some severe consequences and serious consequences that would impede the abilities of the parties to negotiate. That, looking just at this particular case, Mr. Neal, Mr. Ward, as was noted earlier, November 2017. I would find it hard to imagine that this case would still be pending if it weren't for this attempt to certify a class. That statistically, even if the court were to have issued a precedential decision, it might have done it by now. A single-judge decision likely would have been issued by now, and it's quite possible that the parties even would have negotiated, a joint settlement at this point. So I think that's also very indicative of some of the problems that would arise, which is, again, protracting the litigation of the two veterans who have waited for their day in court and who quite possibly could have had their cases resolved in their favor already, either jointly by the parties or by this court. I understand, Your Honors, the idea of wanting, future veterans or prospective veterans or respective appellees to have the benefits of the application of the proper interpretation of the law, but that is the quintessential function of this court. Issuing a precedential decision when it believes that there may be some inconsistencies in the application of the law or where the Secretary is misapplying the law, that is what this court has been created for. And it is, again, it is right there within this court's purview to issue that precedential decision and to use the tools that are already in its toolbox.
Ms. Morris, yes. I agree with you that certifying classes should not be the function of this court. We're an appellate court, not a district court. But the Federal Circuit said we have that authority, and we're a hybrid court anyway, unique in the federal system. And I wonder if we, the court, weren't looking at some kind of aggregate resolution mechanisms that might, in fact, help the Secretary deal with the huge backlog of cases. Is there a way the Secretary will look at aggregate resolution mechanisms to deal with 450,000 cases that are backlogged?
Can the board do that? I can't speak to what the Secretary may be contemplating with respect to actions at the administrative level. And certainly the Secretary it does not object to the idea of efficiency. And I'm not standing here today suggesting that we're advocating for an inefficient system. But, Your Honor, I mean, you don't need a table saw to cut a loaf of bread. There are times where you have the tools already at the disposal. And one of the concerns that the Federal Circuit pointed to was the lack of precedential decisions, from this court. This court has shown the Federal Circuit that it was not necessarily by the party's operation, but that the court has the ability to increase the number of precedential decisions on its own. Just the very fact of a class action, the fact that one has to meet the numerosity requirement means that this is an issue that is being repeated. If the issue is being repeated, then settling a single case won't prevent the court from hearing that issue. If it's a one-time-only issue and it's settled, then perhaps, but would that really be a priority and would that even meet the numerosity requirement? No. So, again, a class action doesn't solve the problems that are, perhaps inherent to the court's ability to issue decisions. The court can on its own call a case to panel. The parties can move for a panel if the parties see that there's an issue that needs to be resolved. This court, even in this case, used aggregate action. The court combined two cases right now. That is something that can certainly happen still. But, Your Honor, there are tools here that can accomplish the goals, you know, that are arguably being frustrated. And yes, Your Honor, like, we do absolutely strive for efficiency, but convoluted class actions does not promote that efficiency. And while it may be so that a class action at the administrative level would take care of some of these issues, that's not what the Federal Circuit authorized. That's not what this court is authorized to do. The Federal Circuit saw some issues, and it was dealing in a writ context as well, which is very important because that actually is a situation where the Secretary acting in response to a writ would unilaterally moot out a claim, even if it's to the benefit of the individual veteran in that case or the petitioner. It does have the effect of mooting out the issue. But even then, there are exceptions to mootness, too. And those exceptions, you know, which this court has recognized in case law in the past, they do exist. So it is still something that would prevent the frustration, the pure frustration of judicial review. So, Your Honor, I see that my time is running out. And while I understand that, you know, I get... I'm sorry?
You'll have more time.
I won't use my...
Much to your chagrin.
I think that's a good thing, Mr. Morris. You had 5 minutes.
You know, I get it. You know, there's a new fancy tool, you know, that's at the disposal, and I know that everybody wants to be the first to use it, and everybody wants to use it, but there are a lot of consequences that come to it, and there's a lot of consequences that come with using it hastily. Again, Your Honor, you don't need a backhoe to plant daisies in the yard, and that's precisely what the appellants are trying to do here. Again, we have tools, and this court has already called this case to panel on the merits of the issue. So we're not lacking, you know, the prospect of a precedential decision. We will have that precedential decision. And I would add, too, Your Honor, that it would only add immense more complications for the court to issue a precedential decision and certify a class, because who would be bound by what at that point? I mean, the class would be bound by the class, you know, by the class declaratory relief. There would be a precedential decision. Now, precedential decision, Your Honor, one, applies to literally everybody in the entire system, whether or not they would ever fit in the class, if, you know, if the issue were to arise. Rather than litigating who fits into the class initially, rather than class members having to try to later on litigate to prove their membership in a class, issue a precedential decision, and everybody is bound by it the same way. And I would add also, Your Honor, one of the fundamental, you know, points of jurisprudence here is that ability to take a precedential decision, to analogize your facts to it, to distinguish your facts to it. We're looking at a particular case here where perhaps the answer is a little bit more black and white, but maybe it's not. But it is the party's rights, and it is part of American jurisprudence to be able to take a court's decision and to analogize or distinguish it, which doesn't happen in a class. Judgment.
I have a question. In
yes.
The appellant's motion for class certification, his brief, their brief, they stated statistics that say that there are approximately 30 board decisions in 1 year, and that likely represents about 750 RO decisions that rely on this unlawful permanent aggravation. Is that a reasonable extrapolation of numbers from your perspective?
Your Honor, it's speculative. I don't necessarily, I mean, given kind of what our position is, I don't see a need to dispute it. I mean, I can certainly accept that, you know, for the point of argument. Again, it is still our position that those who do not have final board decisions, this court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction over those claims. But again, even assuming that, it doesn't change the fact that this merely convolutes, you know, the ability to provide a remedy, you know, to these veterans. And again, Congress created a system for if the Secretary, you know, does misapply the law, there is multiple layers of appellate review. In fact, this court was created for that very purpose, to ensure that the Secretary doesn't. And this court has been doing that without class actions in the direct appeals context since its inception. And, you know, the extent that the appellant, you know, here argues that Allen was completely clear and that this law has been existing since 1995 and the Secretary simply ignored it, well, Your Honor, with due respect, this it's now 2018, and this is the first time that this issue is really being raised is recently. So clearly, it couldn't have been that clear where everybody just dropped the ball on
it. Well, it was pretty clear before Erie v. Tompkins what the status of the law was, wasn't it? 150 years of
I was not
law?
Possibly.
Turned on its head because the Supreme Court decided to change it. So what's the problem? We've had aggregate action since Edward the Confessor. We just haven't used it. Now we've been directed to use it. Some of us believe, just some of us, have believed that we've always had it and should have used it.
With due respect, I don't believe that the court was directed to utilize it in every context. I do believe that it is a resource. It is a tool that the court does have the power to use when it's appropriate, when it adds to efficiency, when it promotes the goals of the class actions, many of which never will arise in the appellate context, such as the need to hire experts, the need for cross-examinations and discovery processes. So many of those will never arise in this appellate context. And again, appellate courts have existed for years without having to certify classes on their own. And they have accomplished their goals of interpreting and declaring the law and ensuring that the law is correctly applied. And I believe that this court can do the same thing. And again, I'm not suggesting that the court should advance an inefficient process. It should avoid advancing an inefficient process, a process that adds more litigation, unnecessary litigation, needlessly protracts the ability to provide relief to the veterans, including these two veterans who have waited for their day in court and are now sitting here with further litigation that we don't need. Because, again, a precedential decision would accomplish all of the goals. An individual memorandum decision would also address their needs. So thank you, Your Honors. I do see that my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Morris.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll first address the merits and then the class action. With regards to the comment that permanent in this instance simply means something measurable, that is not actually the case in what is happening here, Your Honors. Allen, in 1995, said that there is a difference between the standard for aggravation under 1153 and 3310. And so to suggest that permanent can be applied to 3310 cases is incorrect under Allen in 1995 and is incorrect under the plain language of the statute and the regulation, neither of which require the level of permanence. And in many other instances, the VA and the Secretary are capable of measuring injuries and disabilities that are not permanent. We have, as was conceded even in argument, stage ratings can be applied. Those are not for permanent increases, but for temporary, but we contend that that same ability can be applied here in this context as well. In fact, McLean also stated that a disability that resolves itself by the time the end of the claim has even been finished can still be compensated. And that is certainly not something permanent if the injury has since resolved, but it is still able to be compensated, which means it is able to be measured. And so to suggest that permanence just means measurable is not the case and is not required here. And not only that, we have it being used to prejudice veterans in this instance. It's not just a guidance to medical examiners. It's something they are taking seriously and that they are using when they give their examinations. We have prejudice here by the examiners when they are looking for aggravation. They're looking for permanent aggravation. We have for Mr. Ward, his private physician, he did have a private physician that reviewed his injury, suggested, and this is on page 2050 of the RBA, stated that he found that there was aggravation between his service connection disability and his secondary disability. But when the VA examiner looked at him, he found no aggravation, and it said no permanent aggravation. And so we cannot know whether the examiners would have actually found aggravation but for the unlawful permanent worsening standard being directed to them. Because of this prejudice, which is enshrined in the M21, and so being applied across all levels of the VA system, we need a class action here to resolve the issue. We don't seek this court's effort to get into the merits of every single claim, as was suggested. What we ask this court to do is to enforce the proper legal standard of 3310B, which does not require permits, and to declare that, again, as it was already done in Allen, to be the proper standard. And then what we ask for is the injunctive relief to then help certify the class and enforce the proper legal standard throughout all of the class. This would not require meddling in the merits of each case, because the real question in every class member is whether the correct legal standard is being applied. It is not anything more specific than that. At a broad level, we are asking the court to just enforce the proper legal standard. And then to do so would not be unusual or too different from anything this court or even the secretary has done before. There are several instances of aggregate relief being used. It just so happens that one of the new tools in the toolbox, as granted by Federal Circuit in Monk, is class certification. We have the secretary able to do something like this in Niemer, where there was a class certified, and they were able to find all of the class members. They were able to determine those who had been prejudiced at the time, and they were able to re-adjudicate those claims. The part of the class certification that was the most benefit to the most veterans was that the class counsel could then check in and ensure that the proper legal standard was actually being given. And when there was an issue, they could go back to the court and have the court bring an enforceable order against the secretary to actually ensure the proper adjudication of those claims. We also have something very similar in NOVA, in that case, or with the National Organization of Veterans Advocates in 2013. The secretary there agreed to a plan where they would give notice to all members who had been affected with a proper improper legal standard, something we are asking them to do again here. And again, to re-adjudicate those claims for those veterans who had been improperly given the improper legal standard. And that is all we are asking again to do here. It just so happens that the Federal Circuit in Monk granted this court the ability to apply to enforce class actions. And this case is exactly what the court had in mind in terms of class actions. We have an instance in which claims scheduled for presidential review have been mooted out under joint motions for remand. And while the secretary argues that the joint motions are the best thing for the veterans because it is something they've agreed to, while in those instances it might have been best for that veteran at the time, what we have here is a long history of the delays evading judicial review. When the M21 was changed in 2011, we think because of the Donilon decision in 2010 that required permanence for 1153, which then changed the manual in 2011. It took another 4 years in 2015 before a case came up for presidential review, and that was Cook v. McDonald. But again, that didn't reach presidential review. It was slated for it, but a joint motion for remand was granted, in which the secretary conceded that the wrong standard was applied, and the standard applied was permanent worsening.
Ms. Fresquez, if the court were to agree with your position on the merits, would it be advisable to simultaneously certify a class?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
To certify the class.
Isn't there some notice requirements that go into certifying the class, and after the class is certified, and wouldn't it be advisable to have a time period in between such a decision?
Well, Your Honor, we find the two issues to be very intertwined and related. So to properly, once again, enforce the proper legal standard under 3310B and declare that it is not a permanent worsening standard, doing so would then provide the immediate relief to Mr. Neal and Mr. Ward, but then certifying the class, because the class includes all those who have or will be affected by that unlawful permanent worsening standard. We then would ask this court to order the parties to confer and to work out the plan for notice. But as mentioned before, the secretary has provided notice to persons affected by improper legal standards several times before, and we don't think it would be a problem to provide that notice again here. And should there be class members that would prefer not to be in the class, if they don't wish to be, that is certainly their prerogative, and we would not force anyone to be in the class. We're not seeking to replace other counsel that might be representing veterans. We simply ask this court to ensure and enforce the proper legal standard under 3310B. And to that end, this court does have jurisdiction over all class members. The Federal Circuit in Monk actually says that the authority of this court is not confined to the issuance of writs, but it actually extends to those cases which are in the appellate jurisdiction, although no appeal has been perfected. And that is what we have here. We are on appeal, but this court has the power to help all veterans across the VA system. By issuing the class, or certifying the class action, this court can provide the injunctive relief necessary to immediately change the M21, not wait years to change the M21, but immediately effect change for the veterans on the ground at the first level at the RO. And we think that is, in fact, in the best interest of the most veterans here, is to help adjudicate those claims immediately and not wait for them to have to get up to the level where they might have a joint motion for remand. We think it'd be better for these veterans, by definition, have multiple disabilities, who may or may not be represented by counsel, who may or may not have the time it takes to get up to this level. As we saw, it took 4 years for the first case after the manual change in 2011 before we saw a potential panel, another 4 before we got here today. It would be in the best interest of the most veterans to have the injunctive relief to make immediate change across the VA system. And in fact, that is what the Federal Circuit in Monk said that this court should use class action to do.
Aren't you really, do you agree that Justice Alito in Henderson said that our court acts as in a manner similar to an Article III court in reviewing actions of administrative agencies?
I'm not
sure. Yes, you do.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. I would agree.
And that being so, don't we have a history long before 1966 and Rule 23 on class actions? Again, because before that, it's always been part of our jurisprudence, as well as that of English jurisprudence, aggregate actions. So why isn't it appropriate for this court to do what Article III courts, appellate courts, have done just in recent memory? Overcrowding in state prisons, voting rights in the South, busing in the Northeast. Article III courts have no problem in supervising that. Price fixing, you name it. What's the problem here?
May I have more time to address the lesson?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Two minutes.
You don't want, you know, just say no problem.
We completely agree that this court does have the power to issue class actions, and particularly in this case, for 3 final reasons, Your Honor. One, this case is unique. We're not suggesting that every case that comes before this court justifies a class action, but here we have a precedential opinion from 1995, and it has proven ineffective at this time to enforce the proper standard for aggravation under 3310B. So we need something more in this instance. Second, we have had issues of evading judicial review with regards to how long it's taken to actually get to a judicial precedential decision. And in Monk, as the Federal Circuit said, something where the parties have been evading review, that is precisely the time when this court can take back its jurisdiction and actually make the change necessary to help the most veterans. And third, by satisfying or certifying the class action here, we can do more than just declare what the law is, then require the veterans themselves to go through the process and enforce the and try and seek justice that way. We can have this court effect change throughout the system very efficiently and very manageable. We are not asking this court to do 30 years of litigation, such as in NEMR. This is a very defined class, and we think it is easily manageable by the Secretary, and something we are more than happy to help overview and ensure the proper standard is being applied. Thank you.
Thank you all for a very good discussion. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and recounsel.